want to see all the epic boxes.
Oh, hey, if you're online,
Girl Scout cookies.
You can mute
Girl
yourself.
Scout.
Those that are on Twitch, go ahead and mute yourself, please. Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to call Senate State Affairs Committee to order. Today is Tuesday, March 16th at 2021, not at 2021. Let the record reflect, time is 3:36 p.m. Sorry for the late start. We're trying to get our Teams thing up here with everybody on Teams today. Today, we're going to be meeting remotely, except for myself and my committee aide. On the line, we have President, Vice Chair Senator Reinbold, Senator Costello, Senator Hall, and Senator Kawasaki. Like I said, I'm here in person. I'll talk about that more here in a minute. As the State Affairs Committee Chairman, I've closed the committee room to all in-person meeting, so this was my decision. I asked my committee members if they would stay in their offices today and work, and like I said, I'll continue to explain that. Except for myself, my committee aide, the recorder, and the LAO representative, there are a few members from other staff in the back of the room at this point, but that's, again, just from being here for bills presented today. Everybody else, like I said, is going to be via the Teams link. Typically, I'd remind everybody to turn off their cell phones, but at this point, that's not an issue. But I would ask the committee members and others online on the Teams if they would please remember to mute yourself if you're not speaking, and then, you know, unmute yourself to speak and go mute again. Otherwise, there's a lot of feedback. It's hard to hear. Thank you. Again, a little bit of uncharted waters in this bit today. Staff assisting us is Terrence Shanigan, committee aide for state affairs from my office. We've got Carrie Cooper-Ryder with us today for Senate records, and we've got Alex with us on the LAO. Three items on today's agenda. First is going to be SB 95, search and rescue, surplus state property. Second will be SB 66, members, ledge council, ledge budget and audit. And third, we're going to have a little more invited testimony on Senate Bill 39, ballot custody, tampering, et cetera. Are there any questions or comments from committee members before we proceed with the first item on today's agenda? Okay, I have to give it a little extra time for you to unmute there, so there might be a slight pause, a little more than normal with my usually pretty rapid-fire speaking style. Seeing none, I'd like to address the committee and the public about the developing, kind of what's happening here with COVID and why I asked committee members to stay out for today. We've had a spike in some positive cases, more on the Senate side in the last couple days. So with having some staff that actually have some significant concerns based on age and health items, what I'm trying to do is make sure that I'm taking care of the staff that have significant concerns so that they don't have to be in the room here together, trying to show that we can actually operate. We have a resolution that the Senate passed unanimously to allow us to operate remotely so that we would not be blocked from getting the work done. Unfortunately, that resolution is languishing in the House, and so until the House decides to pick up that resolution and pass it, we're going to continue to force people to be in this petri dish of the legislature or inside this legislative building where there are at-risk folks that are having to come in to do their work because there's things we cannot do remotely. It happened last week in this committee. We had an issue where we didn't have enough people, so bills just sat, and we couldn't move them. And the point is to try to get to a point where we can pass that resolution and allow us to still continue to do the work we are here to do, to pass bills and to get things done, but also allow people that are vulnerable or sick or have had close contact, whatever it is, to still be you know, in their apartment or whatever and work and not be shut down. And we're kind of seeing that happening here right now. So we're kind of taking this little step here today that's a little different, but I hope it will become crystal clear that we can do better than this. This is going to show, I think, today that we're going to hopefully be effective, and a remote operating bill would allow us to work. And so we've been working on this, by the way, folks, for over a year right now, and I've said that several times before. We have some issues of, and I want to bring this on the record because my staff is sitting to my right here. His wife works as a charge nurse on one of the leading COVID floors for over a year now in Oregon. And he told her what was happening here, and her comment was very crystal clear. It's like, and I'm going to use the exact language, you guys are stupid. And her point was is that when we bring in these masks, for example, testing and all that stuff is not really helping. We still have it in the building. And she's like, these masks we're wearing, she's like, they force them to take them off, and they have to put on an N95 mask or better. They have to put on goggles because they know there's transmission of it, you know, into the eyes, et cetera. This is coming from them, not me. I'm not a nurse or a doctor. And a face shield, and then the, you know, the gowns and the gloves and the whole thing. Well, we're not going to do that here. That's pretty clear. That'd be impossible to get us to try to work like that. So we kind of have half measures that are getting into this point. We're forcing people to come in that have vulnerabilities. And so we're either going to have to do one thing or the other is my point. And as opposed to forcing people to come into close contact quarters here, again, this goes mostly back to folks saying, look, the House, get the resolution passed so we can operate. And we can do our business, and those that get sick, have close contact, whatever, we can still operate without being shut down. Last year, folks, I remind you, the legislature took itself out of the game. We benched ourselves last March, and we were not a part of the process for appropriating money, all the CARES Act funding, emergency declarations, all those things. We did not come back together as a legislative body to do the business, and I think we can do better than that. So just to be clear again, I want to make it crystal clear that I've asked the committee members to stay out today for those reasons. I called all of them, and they were okay with staying based on my request, not theirs, it was mine. And we are going to hopefully look at mitigation measures, but if the House will pick up this resolution, I think we'll find a way that we can allow ourselves to do business without making people that are vulnerable have to come in here and work. So we're in kind of weird, uncharted territories, trying to work our way through this and hopefully prove to people that we can operate on teams and other things and allow people that have vulnerabilities to not be here. So that's my kind of 5-minute opening speech. I thought it was important to address why today to do this, but there are reasons that are driving it, and I want it to be crystal clear. So thank you. And just to be clear, Terrence, did I miss anything out of that? Okay, for why we're here today in this strange setup. Okay. Thank you for listening to that. We're going to move on to the first item on today's agenda. It's going to be SB 95, Search and Rescue Surplus State Property, sponsored by Senator Wilson, who's online with us, has staff in the room. One staff, if needed, to come up and testify. As we're remotely operating the committee, we'd like to remind everybody on the public watching that you may submit written testimony regarding SB 95 to my committee aide and our office at SSTA, that's Sierra Sierra Tango Alpha, at akleg.gov. As a note for the committee, today we're going to have the following people with us for invited testimony and or answering questions. So far, we only have one with us, but we do have Senator Wilson online. We have Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. We have Paul Fussy. I hope I got that right, Paul. Lieutenant Search and Rescue Coordinator for DPS. And we don't have anybody else. They may pop up online as we need them. So, Senator Wilson, when you're ready, please introduce yourself for the record and walk us through the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, sir. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. I do believe there's we have Thor View from the Department of Administration also on Teams joining us, I believe, for Senate Bill 95. And for the record, this is Senator David Wilson, Senator for District D. And online, I have my trustee staff, Ms. Jasmine Martin. And in the room, I believe Ms. Jody Simpson is there. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Senate Bill 24 is an act relating to the right of first refusal for our search and rescue groups with the respect of the surplus state property. As Alaskans, we're mostly outdoor folks. Some of us, and someday, possibly have or may require party. By statute, the state troopers are required to lead the search and rescue efforts in the state, and this mission heavily relies on over 1,100 search and rescue volunteers across this great state, Mr. Chair. Many of these groups are purely volunteer and receive little financial support from the state, and some of their expenses can be reimbursed, such as fuel costs, but they, in general, don't receive compensation for their services. We've seen many examples of search and rescue volunteer groups in the news. These groups provide invaluable support during the Haines avalanche this year, the floods that have occurred in Lower Yukon, and on Bear Mountain. This bill provides a small assistance to these groups at no cost to the state. It allows organized volunteer search and rescue groups in the state to exercise the right of first refusal for state property related to search and rescue services before it is sent to state auction or otherwise disposed of. The right of first refusal means that these groups will be given the opportunity to buy the equipment at fair market price set by the Department of Administration before it goes to the general public would have access to it. This is a small way to provide help in these tight budget times to these volunteer organizations to provide such a valuable service to our state. Again, this bill has a zero physical note from the Department of Administration, and would thank you for considering this legislation. And again, online, I think we do have someone from the Department of Administration to answer questions. And as you said, we do have Lieutenant Fussy for the Department of Public Safety. And if the committee has any questions, we can do a quick sectional analysis with Ms. Martin.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Wilson. Let's go ahead and do that just to get that out in the open, and then we'll go with the questions after that.
So yeah, this is Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson, for the record. Can everyone hear me?
Loud and clear, Jasmine. Thanks.
All right, perfect. Thank you. So this is just a two-section bill. Section 1 names this act the Ellie Mae Act, and Section 2 amends AS 4466110, which is our statutes dealing with disposition of state property. And it just inserts in there that volunteer search and rescue groups can exercise right of first refusal to the disposition of state property. Thank you.
Thanks, Jasmine. And just for the record, to make sure I got it right, early on, Senator Wilson, I think he said SB 24 when he started talking. Oh. I just want to make sure it's actually SB 95 for the record. It's okay. I just want to make sure it's clear. So, okay. Too many bills. Yeah, I get it. I do the same thing. So at least it's not Senate Bill 44, right? Because then it could be 44 backwards. And then, no, just kidding. Not going to go there. Okay. So we're going to open it up at this time to the committee if we have questions. And, of course, the Senator Wilson is staff, and we have those other experts. So I'm just going to start with the online. If you have one, hand is great, or you can unmute. And I see Senator Holland. Go ahead, sir.
I just want to say this is a great idea. I used to work at a federal facility down in Louisiana decades ago, and we had access to military surplus. And, I mean, just the my big concern was that there were organizations, volunteer organizations, that did not have the same access to a lot of that. But I just want to say I think it's a great idea. Appreciate the bill.
Thanks, Senator Holland. Just as a reminder, don't forget to – oh, I can see you unmute yourself now. It shows up. All right, learn as we go. Other questions from committee at this time?
Can I just do a nonverbal?
Yep, go ahead. I see a thumbs up
there.
Senator Reinbold, so that's a support. And I will say it is nice to see smiling faces, actually human faces, not behind a mask. I guess that's maybe one weird benefit of doing this on Teams at the moment. Of course, can't see mine, but I can see yours. Great. Senator Wilson, do you think it's germane at all to have any of your experts that would have anything to add, or are they really just okay for questions? If there's anybody that wants to add from that's an expert testimony, it'd be a good time to do it. I'm going to take that as a no. It does not sound like anybody has anything to add. Okay, then if that being the case, and what my plan is here, we're going to, with no further questions from the committee, we're going to thank you, Senator Wilson, staff, and those others that came online. You can, of course, clear yourself off so you don't have to wait for the rest of the meeting. I would like to thank everybody for that. Amendments for SB 95 will be open until Friday, March 19th at 5 p.m. You can submit those to our committee aide, and I believe you might have had a few as well, and we'll just take them up at the same time, Senator Wilson, if that's okay with you.
Yes, Mr. Chair, and if I can just briefly just state for the record what those two amendments might be.
Please, go ahead.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Have been they're both a little bit amendment that would add state following. I would just clarify that this bill only applies for state property and not federal or other property that the state may be disposing of. And our second amendment would add the word obsolete following two on page one, line 10. And this would just be a title conform to be more completely to more complete the language of the bill. Just technical items.
Okay. Thanks, Senator Wilson. I just want to we just get them all done at once. I don't anticipate many, and we'll probably just look to get them all passed in one fell swoop there. So. And with as long as you're okay with that, we'll move on and set this one aside for now.
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Senator Wilson, for showing up today. So we'll clear off that staff, and we'll take up the bill at a future meeting to finish up the work on it. As a reminder, if you did not get a chance to call in and you have written testimony, like I said, Senate State Affairs, SSTA at AKLEG.gov. Okay, we are going to... now move on to the next item, SB 66, members of Ledge Council, Ledge Button Auto, sponsored by Senator Begich. And who do we have? What's that?
You have me, Mr. Chairman.
Hey, Senator Begich, I can hear you. There you are.
Okay, great.
Do you have a staff member that's going to either be here back in the chairs or online that we have?
Online, I'll be joined by Mercedes Colbert. What I'll do is when I'm done with a little description of the bill, I'll mask up and go off to another corner. She'll come in and present the very quick sectional with some commentary on the sectional.
Got it. Okay, so a little different because we're operating online through video. We'll have you guys on the record. Thanks for that explanation. Makes sense, Senator Begich. I want to inform the committee that Senator Begich's office and mine have had previous conversations about the bill. After the conversation, Senator Begich and I agreed the best way forward for the sake of process was to introduce a committee substitute for SB 66, Senate Bill 66, which has made minor changes to Section 1 and 2 and eliminated Section 3 from the original version. Once Senator Begich has read through a sponsor statement and given an introduction to SB 66 and we've gone through the sectional analysis with staff, we'll move the CS for Senate Bill 66. Staff to Senator Begich will briefly walk us through the explanation of changes. I'll object for the purpose of that. And then we will bring Senator Begich's staff back to answer questions from the committee members. Senator Begich, does that sound good to you?
Sounds perfect to me.
All right, sir. When you're ready, go ahead and put yourself on the record. Please begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Tom Begich. I'm the state senator for District J, downtown Anchorage. The bill before us, SB 66, is a bill designed to impact the membership of the Legislative Council and the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. Many of you are familiar with these committees. Some of you actually sit on these committees as well. These committees perform, as you know, a needed and necessary component of the work we do. When we're not in session, the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee acts as it were as something of a finance committee for the body. And when the Ledge Council meets, it meets often representing the entire state on issues and matters of constitutional importance, as well as how we function and run the operations of the legislature. Because of this, and because our work must continue at all times, it's important that these committees represent all Alaskans. However, that has not been the case. The way that the statute reads is that the Alaska statute has established these two committees, both the Ledge Council and Legislative Budget and Audit, to include, quote, at least one member from each of the two major political parties of each house, end quote. However, the Alaska legislature has a long history of coalition caucuses and nonpartisan legislatures. As a consequence, often, as is the case with the current legislature and a good portion of the last legislature, the minority caucus has not had representation on this body. That actually, since 2001, that has occurred in the Senate on the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. The Senate has only included the minority caucus three times, and when it comes to Ledge Council, they've only included the minority caucus five times. As we know, in a state like Alaska, at any given moment, depending on how things fall out, any one of us could find ourselves in a minority caucus or a majority caucus. As a consequence, the reason we are proposing this bill is that we want to be sure that at any given moment, every person of the state is represented with the important work of these two committees. I would just add, Mr. Chairman, one issue that stands out in my mind as well as a result of the passage of Ballot Proposition 2. You are no longer required, the use of party affiliation is actually optional. And so as a consequence of that, there are clearly going to be instances where there may not even be a party affiliation associated with every member of the body. That underscores the importance of ensuring the minority and the majority are both represented on these committees. This bill does not seek to expand the role of the minority on the committees beyond the single seat that it is provided for or the membership that it's provided for under the uniform rules. And the original version of the bill actually affected our uniform rules, so we decided to take a different approach in working with your staff, Mr. Chairman, and with frankly, members of the other body, to ensure that it would be the least intrusive and the most reflective of the population of the state. So effectively, what we're talking about is a bill related to fairness, Mr. Chairman. I know that you are a believer in fairness, and I know that members of the committee believe in fairness as a doctrine. So in the spirit of the Caucus of Equals and in the spirit of the Senate of Equals, I bring this SB 66 before you. I'm now going to turn it over and give me a moment, please, Mr. Chairman, for a transition to my chief of staff, Mercedes Colbert, who's going to go through the very brief sectional on this bill.
Thank you, Senator Begich.
Hello, Mr. Chairman. You can hear me?
Loud and clear. Go ahead when you're ready.
Hi, this is Mercedes Colbert, staff of Senator Tom Begich. And to go through version A, sectional analysis of SB 66, in section one amends AS 2420020. That statute establishes the membership of legislative council. And this section ensures that there is fair representation for the minority caucus of the legislative house on the legislative council. In section two, amending AS 2420161, that section of statute establishes administrative services of legislative budget and audit committee. So this, what section two will do, will align terminology and establish fair representation from the minority caucus of the legislative house on the legislative budget and audit committee. And finally, section three of version A of this bill inserts a new definition of the term minority to AS 2420. That's the chapter that establishes legislative agencies and permanent committees. So that includes Ledge Budget and Audit Committee as well as Ledge Council. And that definition creates a new section in this chapter, AS 2420700, which will now clarify that a minority is comprised of at least 25% of the legislative house membership is organized and has an elected leader.
Thank you. And what I'd like to do right now, if it's okay with Senator Begich, is first I'd like to just ask committee members, and if you don't mind staying there for a minute, and I'd see if there's any specific committee member questions while we have you here in the section analysis before we talk about the substitute. So any of the members online, do you have any questions?
This is Senator Reinbold.
Senator Reinbold, go ahead.
First of all, this is a great idea, great bill. I'm really excited this is being brought forth because you can be a minority of one, you can be in a minority of 18 or so in the House. I've been in pretty much every single segment. So I guess one thing I was going to ask is this the effective date? I haven't recalled that. So one, I just want to know the effective date. Because I know this, I'm on both Ledge Council and Ledge Budget Audit right now, so I don't know if that would impact, you know, this year. So that would be one. And then the second thing, just a clarification, when he comes back up, it's not that important, but when Senator Begich was up there, when he said five and two, I wanted to know if that was sessions that people, when he said that only five times, people were on, I think it was Ledge Council and three times, I think he said legislative budget and audit in the minority, if that was sessions or if that was years. Thank you very much, you guys. I appreciate you bringing this forth. Thank you, Chairman Schauer. This is quite interesting, and it's so great to see everyone's faces.
Thanks, Senator Reinbold. Mercedes, are you good with those questions, or would you like to defer?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Senator Reinbold, through the chair. On your first point for the effective date, this would go in effect next legislature. So this would be impacting the 33rd legislature and thereafter if this passes this year. And on your second point, to clarify, so we went through 20 years of legislative history. So this goes back to through 11 legislatures, including the one that we're currently in. So from the 22nd legislature through the current one since 2001. And I believe I may say the name of the other body and committee. So if that's okay, Mr. Chairman.
Is that okay, Carrie? Yes, go ahead.
Just to be clear, so what the House of Representatives has consistently included minority caucus representation over the last 11 legislatures every year for the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee, while at the same time only this body, the Senate, has included minority caucus members three times in the last 20 years. So that's three legislatures over the last 11 legislatures that the Senate has only had a minority caucus representation for Ledge Budget and Audit. But for Ledge Council, the House of Representatives has only one time failed. So that means 10 of 11 legislatures, the House has included minority caucus representation for Ledge Council. While in the Senate, they've included minority caucus representation only five times out of last 11 legislatures. Does that clarify your question, Senator?
I think it does. Senator Reinbold, you good?
Yes. Thank you very much. Excellent job.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions from committee members before we talk about the CS? Senator, okay, good, that was a good, not a wave. Got it, Senator Holland. You're a little box now. You're not the big guy anymore. Okay. That being said, Senator Reinbold, do you have a motion available for me?
Yes, just one second. I believe it's Mr. Chairman. I move Senate State Affairs Substitute for Committee Bill 66, Work Order 32LS0410/B2B adopted as the working document.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. All I will object for the purposes of discussion. Ms. Colbert, would you please go ahead and give us a back on the record for a moment and an explanation of changes, please? I know you guys are switching out a bit. Sorry about that.
That's okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We're all experimenting together here in this new world. So thank you for your patience. So for the explanation of changes, this is between version A and version B. Section 1 adds language to clarify the Senate and House minority leaders. That's the main change. The House and Senate minority leaders or the minority leaders' designees, they may be members of the Legislative Council. And because we, in this new Section 1, that they were now adding, we're now specifically mentioning one member of Leg Council, so that just simply changed the number 6 to 5 in statute, but this maintains the same membership of 14 members total in Leg Council. So this is just a clarifying thing to reflect that we are now mentioning, now specifically listing minority representation on Leg Council. In Section 2, this language is added to clarify the Senate and House minority leaders, or the minority leader's designee may be members of the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. So this is the same thing in both sections that applies to both Leg Council and Leg Budget and Audit Committee. Section 2 also likewise lists and clarifies that because we're now adding specifically another member of the committee mentioned in statute, it changes the number from 3 to 2, but this doesn't change the number of members in Leg Budget and Audit Committee. It simply keeps it at 12 total members. This is just to clarify that in statute as we are now listing a minority designee. And then finally, we're removing Section 3 from this bill from that was originally in Version A. So Version B removes Section 3. This is because the uniform rules are adopted at the start of each legislature and are subject to change. This section would have had the unintended consequence of codifying existing uniform rule. So this ensures that this is not creating any unintended consequences by removing that section.
Thank
and
you.
That concludes changes.
Outstanding. Thank you very much. Go ahead. Sorry.
If it's okay with the chair, Senator Begich has something to add.
Please do, but just before you step up real quickly, and we can switch places there. Do any committee members have questions for Mercedes on the explanation of changes? Okay, please switch out. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for allowing me to switch out. This is Tom Begich again for the record, State Senator for District J. I do want to point out there is an omission that Senator Reinbold has been able to point out, and it was an intent that there be an effective date set for the next legislature, and I noticed in our versions that that is actually missing, so it needs to be added. There needs to be an effective date established for the next legislature. It's not the intent for this bill to disrupt the functioning of this legislature. So I want to be very clear about that. That's just an error on, frankly, my part. I should have caught it. And so I would just ask that understand that that could easily be amended. That's a simple amendment, that an effective date of that this act would take effect after the first day of the next legislative session.
Okay, well, we'll talk about amendments, but if you would like to, Senator Begich, you're certainly welcome to, as it's your bill, if you want to put that in on the next time it comes up. And we won't have Good. We won't have to ask anybody else to do that particular one if there's other things. Now that we have Senator Begich back in the hot seat, I'll open it up to the committee for the debate on the bill. If anyone has questions, let me know. And this is the weird part of the pause. You've got to give it a few seconds for people to come online just in case. And I am not hearing any from anybody at this time. Okay. Seeing no further questions, Senator Begich, we're going to go ahead and set the bill aside for now and bring it back for the committee another time. We will have, I think we missed amendments. Do we have a timeline on amendments for this one? Okay, to be this Friday, March 19th at 5 p.m. If you have amendments for the committee, please put them in at that time. I knew there was one small part missing here, and we'll bring it up at a further time. Senator Begich and staff, thank you very much for testifying via kind of a new process today on Teams, but it seemed to work out pretty good, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to present.
Okay, we're going to continue on this time. We have SB 39 on the docket now, and this is just invited testimony. It's been previously heard in committee several times. And I want to be clear because I'm getting a lot of questions from folks about when we're going to have the new updated version of the bill. I remember the House was organized, a few weeks ago, and so there's a lot of bills out there. We've turned it in. We are waiting to get that updated version back so we can QC it, make sure it is correct, and then we will have it posted on bases, et cetera. A lot of folks are asking and interested in the changes. So it's coming. Folks, please be patient. It just takes Ledge Legal a long time to draft at this time of the session when there's so many bills out there. So that's all. That's the only reason there's a delay. There's nothing else to it. As soon as we get it back, we're going to post it on basis. We'll put it out on social media. We'll let people see it. And then we will have the following public testimony, et cetera, to debate the bill after that. So it's coming. We're just not there yet. Today we have invited testimony from Chris Miller. Each committee member should have received a PowerPoint presentation via email. The office also sent out several leaks to videos that will provide background topics today. So we're going to talk about in this kind of, where we've discussed before, data security, chain of custody, voter validation, and ballot authentication are concerns, especially when you have a lot of mail-in or absentee voting. And as I've tried to make clear to folks, we're not opposed to those things specifically. We're trying to make sure that they are secure when we use them. So we're not trying to prevent them. We're trying to make sure that as we send ballots out, as we have had Division of Elections on the record here, tell us that there is no chain of custody from the time we send it out. And when the ballot comes back, we haven't tracked it, and people have to call in individually if they want to find if their ballot made it back, and we accept it prima facie. And we even took away the witness signature based on a judge's ruling of her own ruling last year for the general election. So these are things that we are working towards to try to find a better way to do things. We hope our next presenter can help our committee and the public understand elections in a different way as we work to improve the integrity of our election system and restore people's faith. I'd like to welcome Chris Miller to the Alaska State Senate Affairs Committee. Please put yourself on the record by stating your name and a brief introduction, and then you can begin the presentation. And by the way, I just have to mention I'm a whiteboard guy in my previous life flying fast jets, and I love seeing the whiteboard behind you. So when you're ready, sir, please continue.
Fantastic. Hello, everyone. My name's Chris Miller. I'm employed by Oracle. My role is they call me the Distinguished Solutions Specialist. There I really have three jobs. I act as the internal control and accounting expert for both U.S. GAAP and also IFRS and international with respect to SOX compliance, general IT internal controls, and so forth. I also work very closely with developing new products there and really about how to fit a system. My key job is to make sure that when Oracle runs into a problem, specifically they don't know what to do, it usually comes to my desk. So that's what I really specialize in. And I'm really grateful for an opportunity here to be able to talk to you about a few of the technological pieces that maybe will give you some real key understanding of the foundations of what technology is changing and what the implications and the advantages could be for voting. As we go through here, feel free to stop and ask questions. I'm used to, as I do presentations, to have people ask and say, clarify that or what would you do that. We'll also have some time at the end to make sure this is your time. I want to make sure that I give you the information you need to make a good public policy decision based on these technologies and have a working understanding of how they would fit in to help the voters of Alaska.
And Chris, a quick
go ahead.
There, just for one moment. If you have the ability, we're trying to figure it out from this end, but again, like I said, we're kind of learning as we go with Teams and this weird world we seem to be living in at the moment. If you have the ability to share it to the screen, just like that, either that's you or
yeah. Yeah, that's
perfect.
Me.
Thank you, sir. That way people can see it online.
Yeah, I was just getting ready to start it there. So
Mr. Chairman, I just like to say I really appreciate a guy who knows how to use Teams.
I appreciate that. That may be my best qualification throughout this entire thing is you figured out how to work Teams.
Thank you.
So let's go ahead and start here. I appreciate it very much. This is just my bio that I tend to give in full disclosure since the recorder, my wife says this makes me look like a jerk. But really, it's I do that just to kind of hopefully establish some of my credentials here as we go through here. So Oracle requires me to just put this safe harbor statement out here. You know, I'm not making any promises on behalf of Oracle. And then a couple things I just want to do, since I know this is for the committee. I'm an employee, but I'm not really here as an official Oracle representative. I'm not looking to sell anything. What I really want to do is just educate you guys. I used information from a lot of sources. You're going to see things from Oracle's perspective because that's what I know. But I just want you guys to know there are several Microsoft, Amazon Web Services. There are a lot of really good cloud providers that would give you a lot of options here when you're making a choice. So let's go ahead and start. When I start to think about what would I really be looking for, this is in our regular lives, this is what we've come to expect when we do a commerce transaction. We go to Domino's, we look online, or we go in and we expect to see a pizza tracker now. We place an order. It tells us that the order's been placed. It tells us when it's been prepped. And even beyond that, it tells us who's prepping that order for us. It tells us when it's gone in the oven. And ultimately, it tells us when it's out for delivery. And so as you go through even buying a pizza in these days, you're able to know, am I getting the right pizza? What did I order with the pizza? Who's preparing it? Is it being prepared? Is it on its way for delivery? And ultimately, will it make it here? And what I'd like to do is really talk about the equivalent of giving the voters of Alaska their own pizza tracker for votes, okay? Because if we could do it for pizza, we could do it here. And I'd like to show you guys exactly how we would do that. Whenever I'm taking on a topic, I'm a big believer, you know, in the seven habits. And this is the thing from Stephen Covey I always did, is the three things that we always need to know is, why do we need to make a change? What do we need to change? And then ultimately, how do we make a change? And so these are the three things I'd like to address today as we go through it. Now, I think everybody probably has a good feel for why we want to change. So I'll really focus on what to change and how to go about doing it. Here's our quick agenda that we'll talk about. And then this is really the how, what, and why, what it is. When you look at how do we create voter confidence, the idea being one voter, one vote, where when we all look at the results of an election, we feel three things. We understand that there was security and there was freedom from outside interference or any potential manipulation of the results. We know that there's audibility and transparency that gives us those accurate results that we can believe in. And thirdly, what we want to do is create accessibility. The idea, there's an idea that you probably, all of you probably deal with in business called reducing friction in a transaction. And what we want to do is be able to use the technology not to make the barriers harder, but to reduce the friction for the voters while maintaining all of these things. And I believe if we apply these systems, we can be able to create just this sort of thing. Okay? So this is Thomas Jefferson. You know, that we have the government by the people who participate, with the goal being here, making sure that as many people participate in our republic as possible. So here are the big five technological pieces that I'd like to talk about. And what I thought I would do is start with each of these and exactly what they do and how they'll apply to those three things of giving auditability, transparency, security, and accessibility. And those five are the pieces that you hear: cloud infrastructure, multi-factor authentication, blockchain, tokenization, and a digital wallet. You guys probably see a lot of these words and think, man, he's going to get pretty technical. I will try really hard not to do that and make it, if you can make this kind of stuff enjoyable for you. But the big thing I want to emphasize is that you deal with all of these things every day in life, that these run the back office of a lot of things we do. As we go through here and you see these, you'll see exactly how we can make them fit for voting. So the first, let's talk about cloud infrastructure, okay? So one of the things that Oracle is doing, and agree, again, Microsoft, Amazon Web Services, is we're creating these regions. Now, what I really want to focus on here is not our worldwide scope, but what I'd really like to do is focus in here on the United States. You'll see that the key here, that we've created government zone cloud infrastructure warehouses, which means these are going to be FedRAMP certified. They're going to be only for government, and no data is going to leave the United States. It's going to stay in Phoenix, Chicago, Ashburn, and San Jose, California, where we've got one planned. The reason why is because, as you know, across all the countries, if you're dealing with GDPR in the EU, if you're dealing with China and their data, all of these countries have requirements that the data stays within their borders. I'm even working on a sizable project with a Canadian company that wants their data to remain in Canada. And so this is a requirement for businesses all across the country. And what the first kind of core fundamental security aspect is, we want to put this in a world-class data center, but we also want this data to stay in America and not go out wherever where we might lose contact with it or bad actors could have any access to it, right? Once we have looked at where the data centers are, where they wall it off, here's really what Oracle does very uniquely that's really strong. The first thing is that we have what we call a zero trust architecture, and that means that Oracle cannot see a customer's data. There is no way an Oracle employee can go in and tamper with your data. And likewise, we set it up so the customers can't see the Oracle code. Well, what does that mean? If you have other people or within your company that are accessing it, they can't go in and manipulate the code, okay, that would control how things are done. This is one of the ways that you can create this kind of security. And we'll see there are really two major databases that we're looking to create that will rely on this zero trust architecture. You can see here that we have these maximum security zones, which will just make sure that people can't accidentally make mistakes. Okay, when you're looking at this type of control, these are the kind of things that you would expect as these things move to the cloud and are managed in these datas. You can see as we start out here, right at the edge, what you call the edge or the internet. Think of these as the castle walls, where we protect you from denial of service attacks, DNS security, the type of hacking that people do. You have a complete set of monitoring and logging, so you know exactly who's accessing things. All the way up in here until you get into the identity of who is accessing the data. Now, the reason why this becomes really important is because as we move to certain technology, we're going to see that there are really two types of informational ledgers that you want to keep. The first is what I'll call the voting ledger. How did the ballots be cast? And the second ledger that we're going to go through is what we'll call an identification ledger that says, how do we identify who's an authorized voter that's on the rolls and authorized to vote and hasn't voted twice, that their vote's been used? We want to make sure that we can enable great segregation of duties, but also make sure that the security here is so that people can have complete confidence in the security and the controls that are in place for that. The third question when we're talking about base cloud architecture sometimes I run into is a question about scale, all right? So, you know, you have an election in Alaska. We have 750,000 voters. Let's assume that all 750,000 wanted to vote in person on one day, part of that. Here, Oracle, and again, all of the other major ones can do this. On a daily basis, we process 43 billion API calls per day in real time. We can scale up. That's done on essentially what they say is 2,200 compute servers, and we could scale up 750 more of them in 12 minutes. What this really means is on election day, when you have a massive spike in need, Oracle is elastic enough to be able to handle that surge in demand, because the common concern would be, well, what if we, you know, like when you make a run on a store on a website, you crash the website. You can't crash Oracle Cloud infrastructure. The scalability is off the charts. Okay, when we're looking at what would I be looking for? These are the three things that you guys really want to look out for with respect to certifications. The first one that's really the key one here is what we call FedRAMP. I'm not sure how much you guys have dealt with that, but this is the federal cybersecurity standards that are the most, I'd like to say onerous when you talk about from business, but really the highest standards in security. This is the DOD type things, this is the CIA. This is when you hear about the Amazon Jedi Cloud that's being done. It's being built to these FedRAMP standards. In addition, there's DOD standards already baked in. And you can see here, even across other countries, GDPR for the EU, PIPEDA for Canada, and even HIPAA, which is here in the United States. This is it. This becomes important so that people will know that privacy is, you're going to be able to maintain privacy and be protected from, you know, any sort of bad actors. The next thing, now once we've established kind of the foundation, this is where it's going into, because a lot of times, I know when you look at the cloud, early on when we had adopters for accounting and financials, people would often say, hey, Chris, why would I put my most sensitive data, my financial information up on Facebook for everyone to see? And we want to help them understand is that the data that comes into one of these infrastructure warehouses is safer in Oracle's hands than it ever would be in your hands. One, because of the spread out cost, this is security that money can't buy. You know, I suppose the state of Alaska, if they wanted to, could create that kind of a budget, but a private citizen couldn't. But this becomes extremely cost effective, getting world-class security for you. While in addition, you're not putting it up on Facebook for everyone to see. You're literally locking these things into, you know, it's like putting it behind a bank firewall. It's like putting in Fort Knox here for you. The security here is something that we give people confidence in. Okay. The second piece that's crucial is now that we've got cloud and we say, okay, we know it stays in the United States, and we know that people who are unwelcome can't just hack into it, get into the database through a brute force thing. But what about the people that were looking to access the data within these data sets? Well, this is where multi-factor authentication comes from. And you guys have probably seen this. If any of you have kids or grandkids that love playing video games, this is one with Fortnite. It has two-factor authentication. And this is where when they sign up, they want to give a digital gift to somebody. They have to essentially get a code on their phone or an email that says, this is really me on something they have. Over here, I buy a lot of stuff from Target. And when you order something on Target and you want to go do the pickup, what they do is they ask you for your name, but then when you say it's ready, you get a little four-digit code that's texted to you, and you show that to the delivery person, and that becomes the authentication that you have. So one, I knew about the order. Two, I've got the order code. And that's really what multi-factor authentication is all about. What we want to do here is make sure that people that are accessing information aren't reliant on just a single password. You know, if you're like my parents, my dad, he'll get mad because he even has to put in a password. And I'll be like, oh, my gosh, Dad, do you understand who's out there? But other times we put a password and it gets confused, or we worry about someone could access our password. What multi-factor authentication does is it relies on two types of different data for you to access the data. So in this case, think of knowledge as that's my password. Okay, so I have to know my password. Possession would mean, for example, a mobile phone. If you've ever gotten those text alerts that says, would you like to log in? Is this authorized? That's a possession. Inheritance is something that is inherent within you. So this would be a biometric marker, perhaps a fingerprint, something like that that you would use, that you have that. Location, because we can track the IP addresses, one of the things for multi-factor verification here might be, is it an authorized voting booth? Because we don't want just people voting off their iPhone, maybe someday, but as we roll this out, no. And time, is it within the prescribed time bands? You don't want people voting after the polls close. Well, the reason why these things become important is really for two major pieces here. The first is the election database that has sensitive information. One, we have the voting ledger, but two, let's say people want to be able to authenticate and say, here's my ID and track this. We want to make sure that the people who have access to this information, that can't be compromised, that they have proper segregation of duties. You know, certain people can't get into certain data, but that we also have so that we know about this. The second thing is for what I would call a voter identity broker. One of the things that will happen as technology comes is the authentication for a voter ID law right now is really, you know, someone shows their ID, you look it up on a paper log, it's very archaic. The way the systems could do now as we start to get into this is that we could create an identity broker system where someone could upload a picture of their ID, and then have a multi-factor authentication being a something to their cell phone or an email address. And that way you can this is the way to guarantee and vastly reduce that there won't be fraud of someone, say, taking over the ballot for somebody else. I know that can be a common concern, is if we were to use an electronic system, how do we make sure that person is really not just putting something there? And that's where this multi-factor authentication comes into play. Now, I've covered two of the three of the five here. I'll just pause there and see if there are any questions. I want to make sure that I'm not going too fast, but I also know you guys are really smart, and I don't want to go too slow for you either.
Okay. I'll pause for committee members. Anybody have questions at this point?
I'm good. It's very interesting.
Thank you. Anybody else?
Fantastic.
I've got a couple I'll throw out there just to generate a little discussion.
Sure.
Let's talk about some other countries from what you know. I made the point earlier a few times that I would be surprised if China, Russia, other countries would allow another country to have their servers or information flow through there for their election systems. Are you aware of, say, example, like Russia or China, do they allow, and you kind of mentioned it, but I want to have this like more of a debate, if you will, of to allow, for example, American servers to control the information for their election?
Yeah, the short answer is absolutely not. In fact, it goes beyond that. They will not allow private citizen information or business information to cross their borders either. So in China, where Oracle does do a lot of business, all those data centers for China are located in China, and we have a very similar thing where the European Union has a very similar data governance policy with GDPR that's come through, that's even become more strengthened. And so not only would it be with respect to this, but they take it two steps further and say, we don't want our citizens' private data or business transactions flowing through to other countries as well.
Thank you. Two more kind of question topics here, see if anybody else has one after that. We had a Division of Elections, issue with insecurity in 2019, and then last year in 2020, we had the Division of Elections. I'm sorry, I get that PFD data hack 2019, their permanent fund division, and then Division of Elections data hack in 2020. Some of the things you see here, and you've kind of illuminated them, but just specifically talking Alaska as a state that has had recent data breaches that could very easily affect our voting system as far as people's information that was floating around, how it could be used, who has their hands on it, was it a foreign entity, et cetera. Can you address how, you know, things like that that have happened to the state, that the types of systems you're discussing would prevent that from happening?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd love to. Let me back up right here to what I'll call my little security rainbow here and just kind of talk through the various layers that you have to do. So a lot of times the way hacks will happen are really from a few different sources. The first is that they will attempt to impersonate here to get the data. And so this will come from, for example, a compromised password, allowing someone to have admin access who should not have admin access, for data not being encrypted. Those types of things are really solved here by having the right tools for the correct data governance policy. So what are those? The first is the first principle that you'll often hear is you want people to have the minimum accessibility needed to do their jobs. Okay, so that when we set up these various tiers of security, that is being managed. And oftentimes, you'll see that in government where I deal with the segregation of duties for audit companies. That can sometimes get a little bit lax if you have people where you're understaffed, people who don't know, and it seems very simple. Like, I would like to let, for convenience, let this person be able to do this job as well, and they may seem unrelated, but they give you access where a bad actor or someone who perhaps is being compromised could actually access that type of data and release it. Okay, so that's the first thing. We give you the tools to be able to manage those correct segregation duties. The second thing is, when you try to compromise something, when you use two-factor authentication or multi-factor, it could be three, you reduce the chance of failure with someone impersonating a user drastically. So think about it. If someone got a hold of your password, but if they don't have your phone where the code comes from, it doesn't work. If they get a hold of your phone but don't have your password, it doesn't work. And so these various factors create like it's a multiplicative thing there to reduce your audit risk or your hack risk. Now, if we step out here into the extra places, you'll notice here that we have complete backups, root of trust, sign firmware. This is in the idea that your security with your server is absolutely things. So people can't just go accessing even the machines that they're on. So think of it like this. We have in the cloud infrastructure, if you had your personal computer, it would be like having passwords and security to access Outlook, Word, your files. But then on top of that, here at the virtual network, this is like having your computer with an encryption password you have to put in the front, that without that, you can't even get in to try to do the other pieces. And then ultimately, out here on the outside, this is really where the people who are trying to do, where we do penetration testing. This is where, you know, you think of the Eastern European hacker trying to get in and steal credit card numbers, or shut you down with a denial of service and shut down a particular thing. All of these things are essentially being protected and managed on the outside. So what this really comes down to is, on the outside, we use this infrastructure to cut down outside people. We use two-factor authentication to cut down people who might be in that gray area where they have some inside access, but not enough. They need to compromise that. And then on the internal side, we can manage access it to degree with the segregation of duties that it would really take collusion from multiple sets of parties to be able to create any sort of breach that you would have.
That's awesome. I have a couple more questions. I'm going to ask you one and sure. Just check with committee members as we continue so we keep moving. As we've discussed multi-factor authentication, what are your thoughts on how that might work with mail-in or absentee-type voting? Because obviously one of the concerns, as we have tried to address, is we don't want, and you've mentioned this as well in the briefing so far, is we don't want to provide more obstacles to people voting. We want to make sure that everybody that's eligible has access as best we can while securing the system as best we can. So within the scope of what we're discussing, how would you see mail-in and absentee voting working that meet those requirements?
Sure. I'll give you the 30-second answer if that's okay, and then I'll talk about it in a little bit more detail as I go cover a couple of the other pieces of technology.
If you want to wait until then, that's fine. I don't mind.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. If that's okay, I'd be happy to do that.
You bet. Please continue to where we were then. Well, let me ask first, other committee members, based on where we are right now, any questions? Okay, hearing none, please continue on.
Right. So let me just scroll back through here, and let's talk about the third piece of technology, the blockchain. Now, a lot of times when people hear about blockchain, you think about, Elon Musk, punching up Bitcoin, and you're like, what is this? We've got some cryptocurrency mined out of nothing, not backed by a government, so it's a fiat currency with no backing, with that. And that is really where the idea of a blockchain started. But think of a blockchain as a little bit more of it. Well, I'll talk about it. But this is the real-world applications beyond cryptocurrency where this can do this. So Walmart is using this right now for both orange growers, lettuce, and various other farmers. And what they do is when a farmer is on the farm and he grows the crops, puts in the boxes and transfer it, there's a document often done when it goes to the packing house. They record that here in this blockchain ledger, okay? That becomes something that the farmer and the packing house now have an agreement based on this electronic blockchain ledger. The two pieces of paper are essentially recorded in this link from packing house to transportation, all the way to exporter, through processing, distribution, all the way to Walmart. At each step in the places there's handoffs, these things are being tracked. Now, why is this important? It means that we could, if there's a lettuce recall, for example, Walmart can go back through, and when they see exactly from which lot that lettuce came from, they can track through the blockchain in the matter of just doing some analytics and identify the farm from where that came from and the packing house in a matter of seconds by crunching that. Because each stage of the transaction is identified, well-known, and easily accessible. And so think of this as the ultimate chain of custody thing is what we're going to use the blockchain for. We're not going to, do any sort of weird things, with currency, and there's not any sort of technological tricks here. What this is really designed to do is enable you to have a lot more transparency and security as things go through. And let me show you kind of how it does that. These are some Oracle slides that, we often talk about. But the real reason that blockchain is being used, and when you look at, well, who is using it? Walmart, IBM, virtually every major bank right now is going to transfer banking onto these things. It's really for three reasons. you can create a sense of trust because every party can see both sides of the transaction and there's a history. And because of that, that gives you really like a single source of truth. You can go to the blockchain, if you will, the ledger, and see exactly what happened to those oranges or that lettuce along the way. That means people no longer will need to argue about, well, is that my fault, your fault, is that my lettuce, not your lettuce, those types of things. Well, in the context of voting, we would, and I'll talk about how we ensure anonymity and how these work in a little bit, but in the context of voting, the idea would be on this blockchain ledger, you could log in, and there would be two things. One, on your private account, so to speak, you could see that your vote, what it's where it falls in the blockchain and confirm, yeah, my vote's in there. The second thing you could do is you could very quickly tabulate and see exactly what happened, the vote tabulations. They essentially become almost like a public ledger that everyone can say, yep, I agree with that. This is what happened. You can data mine them for analytics. You could quickly look and see if there were any sort of inconsistencies or discrepancies that happen with it. And the third thing is that these things can calculate incredibly fast. So right now, you can process approximately on the most complex ledger, and a voting ledger would be simpler, approximately 12 Ethereum transactions. That's one of the cryptocurrencies per second. And that's how fast it writes to a block. Well, so that can quickly scale up to where all of the – essentially the counting can be done in a matter of mere hours with all of this ready to present to go. If the blocks are created by early voting or absentee that are counted ahead of time, then that time of processing is even reduced. The goal here is when you look at this, you can avoid unnecessary delays. The idea here is the more this is automated, essentially through a transparent process – you eliminate a lot of manual labor, manual paperwork, and that. Now, I don't want to imply that this requires going completely digital. That's a possibility, but where we're at right now talking is like, how do we manage this with paper ballots? And I'll get to that in just a moment. This is kind of what I talked about, but what I'd really like to show guys is what really makes a blockchain work is a couple of these things right here. Okay, so if I were trying to explain it, how does it work apart from all this technical gobbledygook? Right now, if you're looking at a bank, this is when you're dealing with the bank has the bank ledger, and then if you guys or myself, and we deal with the bank and we get our statement, we have our ledger, if you so to speak, what we have and we feel we have in our account. Let's say there's a discrepancy. Well, what happens is, the bank says, hey, whatever I've got, that's the source of truth. That is what's right. And you have to now go convince the bank that there's a problem. You have to be like, you got to research this, and you got to go through this. Okay? The idea of a blockchain is that it's distributed amongst several different nodes. So no one person owns the entire single of truth or no one server or no particular piece, but instead it's distributed all across. Now this is it, and what happens is as the blocks are written, it's essentially replicated across over. Now so what happens, and then this is the reason why people say blockchain is very fraud resistant, is that as it writes the blocks and everybody gets it, if someone were attempting to commit fraud or do some sort of injection and change it, they would literally have to go and change over 51% of the entire distribution nodes at the exact same time. If there's a discrepancy, a node A and node B and C and D say one thing and node E says something different, well, you can rest assured node E is where the problem is, and that's where you go looking at it. Well, over here, the way it does that is this would be an example of a transaction. So let's say we were just selling something, and this is kind of my debits and credits accounting, and I sold something here for $1,000, and here's where it came in, and then these are my books, these are your books, but out here on the distributed ledger, it's recording, both sides are being recorded. What accountants and financial people that are looking to use blockchain are calling this the evolution from double entry accounting to triple entry accounting. So what you'll enter your double entry on your books, they'll do it on theirs, and then the blockchain will take both of those and essentially stamp it so you understood. Now, what this does for you now is if there's a discrepancy, if there's a disagreement, hey, you can go here to the ledger and see essentially how the transaction worked. So there are all kinds of applications. So let's say we were looking at, in the state of Alaska, you guys were looking to track production data for severance taxes. This would be where, you guys would have people put in the production data for severance taxes, and then essentially that ledger would become a public ledger of what was done. Same thing if you needed to do, if there's a division order and where are payments going and you want to track that, well, a blockchain is an ideal way. Likewise, land leases for recording the deeds becomes because you have an unmutable chain of custody as to who owned that land, at what time, when, who brought it for, okay? Same thing here with voting. As the blocks are created, you can see exactly how the votes were tallied, and by that have the auditability. So let me just move to the next slide here, okay? Now, on the blockchain, there are really two kinds. There's permissioned and permissionless. So Bitcoin and Ethereum are permissionless. Any of us can go in and buy some Bitcoin, pay with something for some Bitcoin, feel like we want to invest in some Bitcoin. The second one is a permissioned blockchain, and that's where people are invited in to join the network. And what I would propose is that you would want to create a permissioned blockchain network if you were looking to do this for voting, because essentially the people who are permitted to join are authenticated voters who have received a valid ballot, making their vote at the right time, in the right type of election. Those permissions are what are going to allow you to have that type of confidence. So let me just show you here real quick what that might look like. I'm not sure how many of you like to invest in Bitcoin or want to see that something like that. But this is a mock-up of a token. So in essence, this is the blockchain record that you would see right here that someone would have that would be adding a ballot or a valid vote to the blockchain. Okay, and this is the QR code. If I come in here and I wanted to say, how did that election turn out once everything was released and promoted? This is kind of what you would see. I would look here and I would see all of the transactions. In this case, where I have a value of Ethereum, this would be votes. So, let's say this is a vote for Biden, a vote for Trump, but these totals would be identified against these transaction hashes. And then you could also see the block. This is where the auditability comes in, because every vote that made that up, and that vote then can be traced to where it came. Now, when I say trace to where it came, that does not mean voter identity. I'll show you how we're going to protect anonymity here in the next section. But this is what enables you to say this vote voted this way and how these total up. If I wanted to go in and even see a little bit more, you could see, as it was posted, whatever additional data. And you guys, we could really create whatever we would want here on this, in essence, for this voter wallet, if you will. The other thing is, this is where the analytics come into play. This is just a very simple mock-up, a simple thing, but you can quickly see if I wanted to look and say, what are the balances, in this case, Ethereum balances. But if I wanted to see, what's the voting vault, you could mine this for, hey, what was our voting volume? What did it look like? From what locations was it brought in? And these are the kinds of things that will be immediately available for you. So, exit polling, kind of be damned. You guys will know what actually happened, where, what, how. And that way you can better serve the citizens of Alaska by giving them what they need. Let me just switch back here to here. This is the idea of a blockchain table. And the idea here is when there's no trust between people here but a provider, this is, think of this as the Secretary of State or the registrar, is exactly how this would work. And this is where when you want to maintain a chain of custody, this is a type of blockchain table or model that we would use. It becomes far more straightforward and simpler to manage than creating like voter coin, if you will, with kind of the free for all. So this is the advantage that like an Oracle or an AWS can help bring, rather than trying to spin one of these up yourselves, is you can have these managed permission processes with Oracle standing behind it. I'll pause there and see, this blockchain is probably the most esoteric of all the concepts, and just see if there's any questions about that before I move on to tokenization and digital wallets.
Circle on a couple real quick, but I'll open up to the committee so far if there's any questions. What's that?
This is so interesting. Thank you. Oh, I see Senator Roger Holland.
Sorry, Senator Holland, you can just speak up if you do. Right now I can't see you because of the screen. I should have said that before, so I can't
oh,
see you.
Oh, sorry about that. Sorry, I was using my little hand on there.
Yep, go ahead.
So this might be – so is any state using blockchain to ensure voter integrity right now?
So there are not very many states. Utah allowed some to be used via a blockchain voting system, primarily for people overseas. Military ballots are being stored in a blockchain. There has not been a statewide use. Now, several other countries have done it. Russia has done it for their election security. India has used several. There's several countries that are looking at it. And pretty much each and every country, and for that matter, every major company is really looking for a way to use this. But as far as that, the other place that it was used was, I believe, at the Republican convention. Don't quote me on this because I know you guys are delegates would know. But I believe Vote.io was used on several for both the Democrat and Republican, several of the internal nominations for voting. Now, they did it via phone, but it's a similar process here. So this is it. We're at the beginning.
Senator Holland, go ahead.
I'm good. I think Senator Reinbold might have had a comment or a question.
Go ahead. Senator Reinbold, did you have something?
No, I just wanted to say this is really fascinating. This took a lot of work putting together. It's one of the best presentations. Anyway, thank you.
Oh, I am happy to do it. Thank you for the compliment. I really appreciate that.
Chris, a couple of questions for you here. For the next one, if it goes into token, then just cut me off and go there. But so you mentioned there's quite a few companies that are using this, and some companies, there's a number of them that are actually working on this, or they provide types of services. So generically, without speaking to who you work for specifically, because I know you're just trying to help give us an education here, not pushing a particular company, do you think the states, and I kind of generated this question off what you said earlier, I was just holding on to it, where you said, well, a state could come up with a big budget and do this on their own, or they could use the services that are already provided that are in the U.S., because that's one of the things that we were discussing is, you know, U.S. equipment, U.S. servers, U.S. everything, and not letting it go outside when that has come up as an issue in the past election cycle. So do you believe that a state would be best suited to do this or even able to do it, or would it make sense not only from a budgetary perspective but based on expertise to use an outside server? And I know that could be a loaded question in the position you're in. The reason I'm asking is because I don't believe, based on things we have seen, it's something, for example, our Division of Elections would be able to take on as a task.
Yeah.
I'm just curious if you have some thoughts on you know, kind of where the current state of things are like that.
Yeah, absolutely. So from a commercial perspective, Microsoft Azure is what they call their platform that we call Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. They call Azure. And then, of course, Amazon Web Services. Any one of those three vendors are magnificent at this security and the things that I've talked about, and have very similar capabilities. There are three advantages you could get. When you look at the economics of doing this, every business there's a stampede as we're in this shift to going to cloud. Almost every major technological app coming out now is all on the cloud, and very, very few are actually trying to do it their own. So, for example, Zoom recently became a customer of Oracle. They have essentially unloaded their entire server farm, and the entire Zoom conferencing world here in the COVID is running on Oracle Cloud Infrastructure. Why? One, they outsource a lot of the expertise, they get cost certainty, and quite frankly, when you add up all of the hidden costs, it's when you see a bill, say, from AWS or Oracle, you look and go, wow, that's what you're paying. And then you think, well, I could buy servers for that, and I could, you know, the electricity. But you start adding in electricity, cooling, all of the overhead and labor that's required, the contractor costs. Pretty soon, going with one of the major cloud providers looks incredibly economical. A competitor of Oracle's in the cloud ERP space called Workday. And I'm not sure if Alaska uses Workday for human resources for the state. They have a lot of the states where they do the payroll and all the HRIS. Workday, for all of their customers, and they do, everything they do is on Amazon Web Services. So when you access Workday, what you're really doing is it's a skin of Workday, and everything in the back office is running on AWS. And so I'm a believer that, you know, if I was giving advice, put it out to an RFP and get the, you know, make it as a competitive deal. But either AWS, Microsoft, or Oracle will provide you a service far better than you could ever achieve on your own. They have the skills and everything else. Essentially, Larry Ellison, in our last meeting, he says the future of Oracle is really bet on two things. Oracle Cloud Infrastructure, which is the, and then Cloud ERP, which is kind of like the cloud accounting, which is where I'm at, spend most of my time. NetSuite and Oracle Cloud Financials. And so I know this is a long-winded answer, probably more than you wanted. I apologize. But I just I found that the outsourcing cost-to-benefit ratio makes so much sense that I wouldn't even consider trying to spin it up myself. If I had a startup and someone gave me, seed money, I wouldn't even consider it, under any circumstance. You would buy the infrastructure from Oracle, AWS, or Microsoft.
Thanks, Chris. The reason I ask is primarily because cost is always an issue at the state level. We're struggling in Alaska like many states.
Yep.
And, elections, this is the struggle we have as we discuss it, is we want to make this as good as we can, but we obviously are very cognizant of cost and what is the best and most efficient way to provide the level of service we need, the security that we believe we should have, but also be able to ensure that it is fiscally responsible. And so that's why I asked that question. And that's something we often struggle with, whether you contract it or try to do it yourself. But I would argue, based on what I'm hearing here, that the expertise at the state level does probably not exist to do this on our own. Okay, one follow-up question, then we'll continue, because we've got about 10 minutes left or a little less, and I know I want to get you to finish, but it's germane to this topic area just very briefly. You talked about how you can introduce transparency and vote tracking and ballot for example, a ballot itself in the envelope. But one of the problems that we would face, obviously, is making sure the ballot remains secret and anonymous inside the envelope. Now, it's an interesting dichotomy, because if you go, for example, via fax, they'll tell you right there on the website, for the state, that somebody might see your ballot, might see your information. Hopefully not, but they might, because of how it gets transmitted. So can you briefly just, again, illuminate how it would work for both the transparency of being able to track, but also being anonymous, I couldn't say that word right, through this process. Thank you.
Absolutely. Let me walk through it here, and I'll get right here to the slide that shows that. So the key to anonymity, to answering your question, is this idea of tokenization. And so whenever you're buying something from Amazon with one click, or you use like a Apple Pay or a Google Pay, this is where tokenization comes from. And what is really happening here is I have this is your real debit card. And you want to go ahead and pay for something on the, at the gas station. What the tokenization means is they don't get your real card when you swipe it at the card reader. What they get is this right here, a complex hash, like an MD5 hash or an algorithm of a number that's absolutely meaningless and can't be traced back to this. That's what's called a token. This token then comes into, and for example, this is like Square, if you guys ever used it, and this is what you would call the token vault. The token comes in, and this is under, if you will, lock and key, has the Rosetta Stone of what token actually matches to your correct debit card, so the transaction can be processed correctly. Okay, so if you're looking at this, this is what would happen. If I was applying, here's my social security number on the account, and here's this account number, what would actually be stored in the cloud that someone see would be this, a meaningless social security number and a meaningless account number. But down here in the token vault, you have the map that says, here's the real Social Security number, here's the real account number, and this is how they can be matched up. Okay? So in a, I'll go ahead and skip the digital wallet since we talked about that. So in a system where we want to create anonymity, the way we create that is really twofold, okay? The first thing that we do is, let's say I'm the voter. Sorry, my mouse froze on me for a second. Just, where did that thing go? Well, I apologize. I was hoping to have my laser printer pointer working, and I seem to, there we go. Okay, so if we look right here, I'm a voter, and I come in, and, you know, I'm ready to cast a vote. This is, think of this as the voting booth interface. Now, this could be anything from, I want to apply for an absentee ballot on the web from the Secretary of State or from the county, to I'm actually in a kiosk in the voting booth, or in the traditional line, there's a thing like, you know, when you go to check in at the airport, and you would check in at the airport and then receive a paper ballot that would go through. Now, the way this works is, I'll zoom in here so you guys can see it. Whoops. Here, I hit the, once in a while, I can't work the thing. And this is really where the magic starts to happen. The key is that there need to be two systems to really create anonymity. And this is why I've kind of, everything here has led up to this with the security segregation duties. The first is an identity verifier system. Okay, so think of this as I come in and I show my two-factor, I show my license, I get a text on my phone, I say, yep, I want to vote, and what it does. And so when this verifies it, it creates a key, a voter key, if you will, that says, this voter has requested to vote. This voter has asked for an absentee ballot, whichever type of thing. And that creates a token that comes up in here into the voter booth, into the voting booth interface. And it says, this is a legitimate person, okay, that is eligible to vote. And then what happens is, without having any knowledge of who it was, the registrar, or think of this as the county who's actually issuing the ballot, what they're going to do is they're going to receive what's called a blind token. And the blind token is this. If you get one of these from me, I'm not telling you who it is, just send me back the following ballot, in this case, ballot A, because this has been authenticated from the blind token. So it says, oh, got it. I push it back. Now, what you get here now is that the eligible ballot, if you will, has now been sent back to the interface. And the end result of that is really twofold. The ballot has no idea who the voter is, and the authentication system has no idea what's on the ballot. There's a wall between the two of them where you can keep these completely separate. And so the way this would work is, if I went in person, and let's say there was a kiosk, I would, you know, vote. I would get the ballot on my screen, vote, and then get my confirmation. It could be a printout where I get that hashtag that says, here's what your ballot number was. Off I go. If you wanted people to have a paper ballot at the point, and when this was validated, rather than having an electronic, they could just print out a ballot, and the ballot would have the hashtag on it. The hash key on it, so it would go into the blockchain. But again, there's no linkage between that hashtag and the verification system that's happened. So whatever goes into the blockchain is going to be person unknown. Okay, so think of this as like when you go to the airport. The control is going to be here at the identity verification system, because that's really important. This is like going through the gate at the TSA. We make sure that the authorized people are there, because then once we go in, you essentially have the freedom then to go wherever you like. We're following a similar principle here, where once we have identity verification that's been correctly signed, then the vote and the ballot is going to essentially say, okay, you say that person's good, you've gone through the gate, now you can go to any gate you want by getting the ballot. And then once that's it, and then if we do it by paper, it gets scanned through. And then it goes into the blockchain based on the hash, but we have no connection between who voted and what they voted. But we do have absolute confidence that an authorized person voted who identified themselves through multi-factor authentication, and we have confidence that the vote tallies were correct. And if they're not, the voter, knowing his hash as it comes out on the paper, can look and make sure that his vote, it was included. So you're going to have a lot of I like to think of it as self-service verification, go, yep, there's my vote. So I'll pause there and see what you guys think of that.
Well, I hope you're an engineer to try to keep up with that. That's pretty pretty in-depth. That's a great explanation.
I apologize. I know it was more techie than I wanted to get into. Unfortunately, there's not really a way to do it that's not a little geekish.
No, that's okay. That's part of why you're here, Chris, to be able to explain it from the engineer perspective down to more of a grassroots level. Open it up to the committee. Does anybody have questions on how this works any questions from anyone? Remember, you have to unmute because I can't see your hands.
Mr. Chairman, again, this is Vice Chair Reingold. I just want to say thank you. This is one of the most comprehensive I've ever seen in a committee. Excellent job.
Thank you. Any of the other three senators online, any questions at this point for Chris? All right, Chris, we're going to run a couple minutes over here with if the committee would indulge us. I know you're just about done, but I want to make sure we can finish it up. So please continue.
I appreciate it. Sure. I'm really on the last two slides. And so what I wanted to do here was really tie it together and say, okay, how would these five pieces of technology really come together to build something? And this was an infographic I took from Follow My Vote, one of the companies working on trying to create this. But in essence, if you think about it, you use a digital wallet that's where you would get your verification and use that to authenticate yourself. Then once you, in your digital wallet, you do that and you submit this is where you're going to use that identification system wants to be under the cloud infrastructure and have that security so that people know that when they're identified, that everything is going to be secure. Then what we want to do is use the tokenization technology to make sure that the voter has been authorized to cast a ballot, and using that dual purpose system of blind tokens to make sure that there's that double blind thing to create anonymity regardless of the voting intake, whether it's electronic, absentee, paper, in person. Once we've secured the vote, then that goes into the blockchain ballot box, and that's where it's counted, and that's where the results then can be tallied and analytics can be wrote on. Then when we come back via the vote account, their digital wallet, if you will, they can go in there and verify for themselves that their vote was cast correctly, and they can confirm the results. And then regardless of the intake method, whether it be, absentee, mail, whatever, voter security and voter privacy is maintained. And that's really the key thing to reduce that friction. We want to make sure that we've got that. Just to kind of give you a last example here of what you're doing, this is the patent that the post office filed in August of 2020, looking to create a blockchain system for elections via the mail. You can see here, I actually hadn't worked on this, but the same concepts, that a little bit what I talked to, are exactly what they're looking to patent here with respect to a mail ballot processor on the blockchain, an identity verifier. And so if you're looking for who's another possible supplier or want to do this, the U.S. Post Office is actually looking to be able to create this type of security for absentee ballots, or if you're a state with all mail-in voting, to set this up and to increase this. So in conclusion, I'll just close here with follow up. Here's really what I wanted to accomplish, hopefully help you guys be able to make a good policy decision, is to understand, how would we do this with respect to combining these technologies to make a system? And what are we looking for? How can we create security, auditability, and accessibility? So that ultimately the why is, we want voter confidence. One voter, one vote with an efficient election. And with that, I'll say thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it. If there's any final questions, I'll be happy to take them. If not, thank you for letting me share some of these things I've learned and some of my passions, and I hope it's been helpful for you.
Very helpful, Chris. This is a fantastic presentation as part of what's helping us work our way through to try to meet the requirements of what I've said before, good ballot, election integrity. People restored their faith in the system, where a lot of people on all sides seemed pretty upset the last 4 years. But at the same time, trying to make sure we're allowing everybody that's eligible good, easy access to vote. You know, some of the things we have to consider in Alaska, which we've been talking about, is we've got, low-tech voters. We have villages that are very spread out that don't have necessarily good Wi-Fi and other things that can be, not everybody has a cell phone or even internet access here. We're a little odd in our size and how we're spread out there. So that's things that we'd have to go, consider as compromises perhaps with the bill for, allowing different ways for us to vote, which we are, of course, looking at. It's interesting to talk about the, U.S. Postal Service going to blockchain, something we should certainly be considering if they are. And that's part of what this effort is about. So that's certainly something for us to look at. I would say that, from that perspective, this is providing a lot of information to chew on. And I know we're going to continue to work with you on ideas and things that might provide the opportunity to get us there. Still a long way to go. And I'm going to open it up to the committee for final thoughts here or questions since we're a few minutes over. And thank you for letting us do that. From anybody?
Great presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
This certainly adds a lot of incredible background to why SB 39 is so good. And anyway, thank you very, very much. This was fantastic.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. I don't hear any other questions at this time from committee members. So, Chris, again, thank you. I know we'll be working with you more on ideas and things moving forward. So thank you very much for taking the time today to call in, and we will talk to you later. You are cleared off, and have a good day. So I very much appreciate it.
Great. Thank you very much. It was a pleasure meeting you guys and having the opportunity to do this, and I hope to talk to you again someday.
You will.
Chris, you still there? Sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Senator
Chris
Hollis.
Miller, where are you physically located at?
I'm in Lehi, Utah.
Okay. Thanks so much.
Got it.
Okay. Thanks, everybody, for coming online today and enduring a little bit of a different format here as we work our way through what's happening in the building with COVID response, et cetera, and talked about that before. Our next meeting will be this Thursday, March 18th at 3:30 p.m. We're going to be hearing SB 31 prohibiting binding caucuses. We might bring up SB 39 ballot custody tampering if we have the updated version of the bill. And then bills previously heard. Seeing no further business before the committee at this time, we're going to go ahead and adjourn. At 5:07 p.m., thanks for letting us go a little long.